You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes Friday, and of course, if it's Friday, our first hour is Senator Bernie Sanders, our brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting, where you can call and talk with the man I consider to be America's senator. I know Vermonters lovingly embrace him as their own. And having been a former Vermonter, I'm speaking from experience. But Bernie is just out there fighting for all of us. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome. Bernie?
Yep, right here.
Hey, great to have you with us. I understand, you know, yesterday that the Republicans said they would rather vote with the millionaires than with the average working people, and that you've got some exciting stuff going on with the Fed. I've been throughout the week riffing on your news releases that have been coming out as this information has been coming out. Can you tell us?
Well, there's, Tom, this, there's just so much going on. Let me just very briefly go over a little bit. As you know, late last night, the Senate voted 50-50. We needed 60 votes. We didn't get it. We didn't get one Republican vote. We lost a few Democratic votes on a very, very modest jobs program. And that would be to provide $35 billion to state and local governments to prevent layoffs of teachers, police officers, and firefighters. A very modest proposal, and the bill was going to be paid for by imposing a surtax of all of 0.5% on incomes of over $1 million. We could not get one Republican vote to protect teachers, police officers, firemen from being laid off and losing significant numbers of jobs. And that just tells you, I think, the absolute bankruptcy of where the Republicans are coming from in terms of job creation. Tom, they have absolutely nothing to say on this issue. 16% of our workforce is unemployed, underemployed, 25 million Americans, and the only solution that the Republicans have, if you can believe it, I'm not kidding, is more tax breaks for billionaires, more deregulation of Wall Street, more unfettered free trade so we can lose even more jobs to China, Mexico, and other developing countries. That's their jobs proposal. So when we talk about preventing cops and firemen and teachers from being laid off, they're not there. More importantly, in my view, when we talk about creating millions of jobs, rebuilding our infrastructure, roads, bridges, water systems, rail, public transportation, they're not even in the same room. They're not in the same world. They are prepared to allow our infrastructure to collapse. China invests 9% in infrastructure, Europe 5%, we 2.2%, and we can't get any Republican votes to create jobs rebuilding our infrastructure or transforming our energy system. So that's what you got in terms of jobs. In terms of the Fed, I think many listeners may know that as part of the financial reform bill, the so-called Dodd-Frank bill, we got a provision in there which did a number of things. It provided an audit of the Fed during the Wall Street collapse period, three-year period. And we learned from that the Fed made $16 trillion in revolving loans, low-interest, zero-interest loans to every major financial institution in this country, many major corporations, central banks all over the world, and wealthy individuals. Another provision that we had placed in that bill called for a report from the GAO on conflicts of interest at the Fed. In other words, when you have, for example, the New York Fed, which is largely composed of people from financial institutions who are supposedly regulating themselves. You have people from large banks sitting on the New York Fed regulating large banks. Some of us think it is fairly obvious that there are major conflicts of interest. The GAO published their report the other day, indicated their concerns. And what we are going to do with that is we are put together a commission of some of the leading progressive economists in this country. Joe Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize winner, Jeff Sachs, done a great job in many respects. Bob Reich, former Secretary of Labor, Jamie Galbraith, Lawrence Michel, Naomi Prinz, a number of leading progressive economists who are going to work with me to come up, help me form legislation which will make the Fed, which is an enormously powerful institution, an agency that works for ordinary people rather than just for the large financial institutions on Wall Street. And I consider this to be very, very important. Not quite sure how we're going to lay this thing out, whether we'll have hearings or town meetings on it or whatnot. But it is, to me, you know, we're in the process of formulating that now, but it is a big deal because we're tackling the Fed, an institution of enormous power and very often functioning in secrecy. We held a hearing last week on the recession in older Americans. That was actually the early part of this week. And what we found, not too surprisingly, is that in the midst of this recession, it's not just a lot of elderly people are hurting. Millions of seniors have seen a decline in their standard of living. Unemployment is very, very high. Has doubled since 2007 for seniors. And if you can believe this, in the lower percentile, lower 20 percentile, the bottom one-fifth, you have the average income of seniors in that percentile is $7,500, Tom. Can you believe that?
That's I don't see how you could live on $7,500
well,
a year.
And you can't live on that, and those people are highly dependent on affordable housing, government programs,
food stamps.
Yeah.
Which Jeff Sessions wants to cut now.
That's right. Those are programs that our Republican friends want to cut back on. Now, the good news for seniors is that the Social Security Administration announced for the first time in 3 years that there would be a COLA increase of 3.6%. I believe that's long overdue. At our hearing, we had a panelist, an expert on this issue, testifying to the effect that the current formulation as to how we determine COLAs is inadequate and understates the purchasing needs of seniors.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is get a better index to determine the real inflationary cost that seniors experience, which is a lot higher, I believe, than the current formulation. In any case, there will be a 3.6% COLA increase, which is important for seniors and veterans, other people on Social Security. In terms of Social Security, in terms of Medicare, we continue the fight to make sure that there are no cuts in Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. We are in the midst of a severe, severe recession. Social Security hasn't contributed a nickel to our deficit. We've got to strengthen it. We've got legislation in to do just that. The idea of raising the eligibility age of Medicare from 65 to 67, totally unconscionable. We're going to fight that. And we've been working, doing what we can with the super committee to make sure that they do not end up with a product that hurts working families or the elderly or the sick.
That's marvelous. That is marvelous. And you were successful in forcing through this very, very brief audit of the Fed, the first time since it was created in 1913.
Right.
Will there be future audits of the Fed?
Well, we're going to stay on that. The truth is, you know, the Fed is an institution of enormous power, but it has operated in incredible secrecy. So we are going to keep pushing that. We have already learned a lot, but we certainly have a lot more to learn. Most importantly, I think we've got to reform the Fed to make it a much, much more democratic institution.
Yeah, absolutely with you. We'll be back with your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news source.
The rich are getting richer. The poor just get abused. People in the middle paying way too many dues. Jobs are going offshore. There ain't much left to lose. Most of us are trapped here by the tightening of screws. Election time is coming. There isn't much to choose. The right wing is the wrong thing, but they control the news.
no bottom.
Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Jason in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Jason, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
I'm sorry, it's John.
Oh, John, my apologies.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the comment. I don't know if, you know, Bernie Sanders would be able to do very much about this issue, but we have really suffered under supply-side economics, and, you know, pretty much the Obama administration has continued on with this type of policy, and I don't know, I don't understand why it is that the administration does not, you know, venture out into other areas of economics and, you know, hire these people to make substantial changes in how policy is, how economic policy is being furthered. You know, it's just, they're like the worst as far as an academic profession. They have absolutely no tolerance for any differing types of opinion, and yet there have been some excellent Nobel Prize winners that have advocated a very different take on economics. And
so, John, your question for the senator?
Well, I just want to know why it is that people are not pressuring, or politicians, particularly other Democrats, and Bernie Sanders is not pressuring the administration to...
Okay, Bernie? So,
well, not quite accurate, John. We pressure them all of the time. And as I just mentioned at the beginning of this program, we have put together our own commission of virtually every leading economist in this country, including Joe Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize winner, Jeffrey Sachs, Bob Reich, former Secretary of Labor, Jamie Galbraith, and others, in order, in this case, to be focusing on the Fed. But John's point, his overall point, is right. There is no question that the financial team that the president has put together is a pretty conservative team. That is something that many of us are not happy about. What I believe, and have believed from day one, is the president should have and should today make it clear to the American people that he is on the side of working families, that he is going to come forward with an aggressive jobs program to start creating the millions of decent-paying jobs that we need, that he's prepared to take on Wall Street in terms of lowering the outrageously high interest rates on our credit cards, deal with the mortgage crisis that we are facing, and furthermore, in terms of trade. I was disappointed but not shocked that the president's view on trade turned out to be very different than what he had campaigned on. As I have said many, many times, I think unfettered free trade, NAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, these agreements have led to the loss of millions of decent-paying jobs in this country. Factories shut down, they go abroad. And the president, unfortunately, has continued those policies, continued a freeze on the wages of federal employees. Not good. So in a variety of ways, I think the president has not been anywhere near as aggressive as he should be in protecting economically the interests of working families. So I agree with John.
Mac, in Belafonte, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
I just want to say that I think we need fair trade, not free trade. Because I think if we had fair trade and charged, what, an hour to produce these things, you know, that was what we based our tariffs on, how many hours it takes to produce it, it would help, because it would help us, because our jobs would come back. It would even help the other places, because if they knew they were going to get tariffed out, they might as well raise they could lower their own tariffs by raising the standard of living of their people. So,
well, let me respond to Mac by saying I agree with him. And this is, Tom, just a huge issue which never really gets the discussion that it needs. And the reason for that is it has bipartisan political support. It has the support of virtually all of the media and the establishment who are continuing to push this unfettered free trade despite all of the evidence that our trade agreements with China have cost us millions of jobs, trade agreement NAFTA with Mexico, hundreds of thousands of jobs. In the last 10 years alone, we've lost 50,000 factories, millions of good-paying jobs. And it just, you don't need a PhD in economics to understand that when you can pay people pennies an hour in another country and bring your product back in tariff-free, that is what you're going to do, and that is what they have done. And it's not just blue-collar jobs, it's white-collar jobs. I worry very, very much about the economic future of our country if we cannot rebuild our manufacturing sector and create the good-paying jobs that we need. This country cannot be strong simply by selling products made in China. We've got to build those products here ourselves. As I've mentioned in the past, we've begun to work with some of the federal agencies, the Smithsonian Institute, other agencies, to demand that the products they sell are made in America. We're having some success there, but obviously that effort has got to be enlarged.
It's our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on the issues of the day. We'll be back with more with Senator Sanders in just a moment here on the Tom Hartman Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop into our chat room. It's open 24-7 at TomHartman.com. And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov.
But you got to keep your head up. Oh, and you can let your head down. Hey, you got to keep your head up. Oh, and you can let your head down.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. Senator Bernie Sanders, just a quick breaking news. For the last 2 weeks, several times Tom Hayden has been on this show saying that the President of the United States, President Barack Obama, is going to announce a troop withdrawal to zero by the end of the year in Iraq. It is being reported now that he, in about 15 minutes, is going to be making that announcement from the White House. So just a heads up on that. Back to your calls for Senator Sanders. Will in Lakewood, Ohio, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for all your continued work for the American working man. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on kind of some two ideas that are kind of running contrary for me, and just wanted to get your thoughts. So we know, as people who understand scientific consensus, that global climate change is a looming problem. It is going to be disastrous if not addressed. And that our old system of mass production and kind of, you know, reckless use of the planet has brought us here. At the same time, we are trying to get jobs back and economic growth that were going on for the past 50 years that brought us here. So I am just wondering kind of, how do you reconcile those two ideas? If we, you know, get that economy back that we've had, we're going to have those disastrous consequences and much bigger costs from the global climate change. Thank you. I'll take my answer off here.
Well, Will, thank you very much for that question. That's a very profound question in a sense, because it gets to the root of a whole lot of issues that are out there. What Will is saying, on one hand, is that if we don't get a handle on global climate change and substantially cut back on greenhouse gas emissions, the future of the planet is in doubt. And he is absolutely right, in my view. Despite ExxonMobil and oil company and coal company funded research, which sounds very much like the old tobacco companies telling us how safe cigarette smoking was, the reality is, and virtually the entire scientific community agrees, is that global warming today, not 10 years from now, today is already having a profound impact on this planet in terms of drought, in terms of flooding, in terms of severe weather disturbances, in terms of agriculture. and cutbacks in food production, etc. So there's no question that Will is right. We have to address that. And the other point that Will says is, well, yeah, but on the other hand, if we continue to do more of what we are doing, will we not be increasing greenhouse gas emissions and making the global warming problem even worse? My response to that is that what we need to do is really take a hard look at our consumerist society, that in fact we can create a good standard of living for our people. If, A, we create jobs, Will, in reversing global warming. Right now we have the potential in terms of energy efficiency and weatherization to make huge cuts in greenhouse gas emissions at the same time as we put a whole lot of people to work. The state of Vermont leads the nation in energy efficiency. We can do a whole lot more. Rest of the country is pretty far behind us. But there are homes in Vermont today where we can cut fuel consumption by 30 or 40%, cut back on greenhouse gas emissions, and create jobs doing that work. If we transform our energy system away from oil and coal and fossil fuel to wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, if we start producing the wind turbines and the solar panels in the United States, we can also create jobs. But Will's question goes even further than that, and I think it asked, it's basically raising fundamental questions about the consumer, the consumerist society. Do we need more and more and more? Does that really enrich our lives? And I think we have to take a hard look at that. I think as a nation, what we have got to say is every person is entitled to health care as a right. We are entitled to educational opportunity as a right. I want to see our kids being the healthiest and best educated in the world. But I think instead of just buying and buying and buying, what we need to do is develop a sense of community where people feel good about where they're living, their relationships with other people. So Tom, Will has raised a pretty profound question, but short term at least, Will, I think we can create jobs at exactly the same time as we're cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Longer term, I think we have to take a hard look at the consumerist society that we live in.
Brilliant. Jim in Minneapolis, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
I think it's very important that we progressives can clearly make the case that Wall Street caused the financial crisis, and quite frankly, I have a very hard time doing that. I want to do it. I want to go out there and be a Tom Hartman and do it, but if I were to say somebody robbed a bank with a gun, obviously the bank robber is a bad person, but if I say somebody used derivatives or speculated too much or made bad loans, doesn't have that same impact. Can you help me out?
Yeah, I can, Jim. It's a good point, and I should tell you that while most Americans certainly don't understand the incredibly complicated intricacies of high finance, they do know that the greed on Wall Street, their hyper-speculative efforts, their obscure financial instruments that they created did cause this recession with all of the suffering that has taken place as a result. And now you're beginning to see, although it's much, much, much too late, you're beginning to see lawsuits taking place about against these large banks for having peddled financial products that they knew were fraudulent, that they were peddling products that were worthless. But if your point is that we have to simplify the issue, identify those people who did what they did, make sure that everybody understands that, and at the same time come up with real reforms, I think you're right. But right now, every poll that I have seen suggests that people understand that Wall Street is essentially a fraudulent business model operation, that instead of helping us produce jobs and real goods and services, being part of the productive economy, they are a huge gambling institution, which bodes very, very poorly for the future of our country. So I think you're right, Jim. I think we got to sharpen and clarify our attack. But I think the American people already understand that much of what's going on in Wall Street is counterproductive and in many ways fraudulent.
Suzanne in Corinth, Vermont. You're on the air with your senator, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Thank you, Senator Sanders, and thank you, Tom. It's pretty much a given now, I guess, that any Obama jobs program, you know, is going to continue to be held hostage by the Republicans. I mean, in fact, the country is being held hostage, I think, by them. And it's now sort of being done piecemeal. We saw last night some results of that. Do you think it's possible that if they, if the Democrats primarily can keep this up long enough so that every week or every month there's a vote, and that is obviously, you know, something that's covered on C-SPAN and then on the news. If nothing else, that will keep it in the news, and with the short American attention span, you know, it will sort of constantly be out there that the Republicans are once again voting these things down. Because I can't see with what they're doing how they could be reelected. Do you think that's a strategy?
I think that is what I think the Democratic leadership, and I've been critical of them in the past, as I think many listeners know, are beginning to sharpen their attack to do just what Suzanne is saying. I'm reading from the New York Times right now that the Democrats, the bill that was voted on last night, provided $35 billion to state and local governments to prevent layoffs of teachers, police officers, and firefighters to offset the costs. The bill would impose a surtax of 0.5% on income in excess of $1 million. Suzanne, I think that the overwhelming majority of the American people think that that makes sense. And I think what the Democratic leadership has got to come back week after week after week, just as you said, making it clear that these Republicans could care less that 25 million Americans are unemployed or underemployed. We're talking about, in this case, teachers, police officers, and firemen, people who teach our kids, who protect our lives. They're being laid off. And we're asking the wealthiest people in this country, who are becoming much wealthier, to pay a little bit more in taxes so we can protect those jobs and protect our communities. We can't get one Republican vote. Do I think that resonates with the American people? I sure do. And I think the Democrats have got to keep up that attack week after week after week. You know, when you look at the Republican belief, viewpoint, and how you create jobs, here it is. Here it is. Tax breaks for billionaires. Trickle-down economics. Nobody in America believes that works, because we went through 8 years with George Bush on that, and his job-creating results were a total disaster. Deregulation. We talked a minute ago how Wall Street deregulation caused the recession. They want more Wall Street deregulation. Nobody believes that. Unfettered free trade lost millions of jobs. Nobody believes in that. Those are the major tenets of their job-creating program. It is worthless.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So very well said. We'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting on the Tom Hartman Program.
Time won't slip away. We'll get through all that life can bring. And I know together anything is possible.
Take it back to mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Greg in Brattleboro, Vermont, watching on Bernie's website. Hey, Greg, you're on the air with your senator.
Thanks very much, Tom. And thanks, Senator Sanders, for taking my call. One of the issues that the Occupy Wall Street movement has brought to light is how corporate money has tainted our political system and has really turned our country into more of a plutocracy than a democracy. So in light of the Supreme Court's decision to allow unlimited corporate spending on elections, are there any other solutions or policy actions that can be taken to sort of undermine that? Isn't that kind of a large challenge to undo?
Greg, you're 100% right. Citizens United, I think Tom was actually up in Montpelier, Vermont for a town meeting. We had about 500 people out just talking about this issue. You have, in recent years, had a very, very poor campaign finance system where big money dominated the process, making politicians dependent on special interest, and that resulted in legislation bought and paid for by big money. Citizens United has made it even much worse. So, Greg, you're absolutely right, and we've got to focus politically on how we break the political process's dependence on corporate money and big money interests. What I believe in, and I have always believed in, is public funding of elections by which candidates who show that they have a certain amount of support will get public funding. You have a limit to the amount of money that you spend. And then politicians can talk about the real issues facing their country and their constituencies rather than spend half their lives raising huge amounts of money. But, Greg, you put your finger right on, you know, from a political point of view, one of the most important issues out there. Wall Street is all over this place in terms of money, in terms of lobbying, and that's just an issue we have to deal with. It ain't going to be easy, I will tell you, but you're absolutely right. That is a huge issue.
Carol in Apache Junction, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, this is Carol. It was nice to finally get a cola, but I gained $36 and I could lose more than $100 if the federal poverty level isn't adjusted upward to account for the cola increase. I'm eligible for a Medicare savings program that pays my Part B boy and most of my Part D costs. And if the federal poverty level isn't adjusted upward accordingly, I could kind of fall into a catch-22. How can somebody make sure that doesn't happen to other people like myself, too?
Well, Cheryl, you're absolutely right. There will be an increase in the COLA, more money coming into Social Security. But for a whole lot of folks on Social Security, they're going to see a lot of that increase is going to go right into their Medicare payments. And in fact, you're also right in that the determination levels of poverty are inadequate, and we have to adjust that. Cheryl, all I can tell you is that right now, the fight that we are waging, is to prevent our Republican friends from slashing Medicare, from making you pay a lot more than you're currently paying. In the House, there was an effort to voucherize Medicare, essentially giving you an inadequate check, and you go out into the private sector to buy the health care that you need. So right now, we're kind of in a defensive mode, trying to prevent tax against Social Security, cuts, privatization, raising the eligibility age of Medicare. But the point you're making is absolutely right. Seniors in this recession are hurting, and unfortunately, in many cases, a lot of that COLA is going to go into Medicare payments.
Glenn in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Tom, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Senator Sanders, appreciate all the great work you're doing. America right now, we feel as citizens so polarized and, you know, so the level of morale is so low, being all the problems there that have to be dealt with, I don't think that we're going to be able to recover as a society until a Truth and Reconciliation private commission is put together. And in regards to pretty much everything, I lived down in the Caribbean for a few years, and all the poverty is crippling down there. Those people know who they are. They know their history. They know where they come from. Unlike us in America. I mean, Tom, you and I grew up with Cowboys and Indians and Columbus Day and I mean, basically, we don't know who we are.
So you're suggesting we should have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission like South Africa did and just reboot the system and purge?
Well, I mean...
Yeah. Is that the question to Bernie?
Yeah, but broad, though. I mean, we know that the hedge funders took out huge insurance policies against all these mortgages.
Right. Okay. Let's toss this to Bernie, Glenn, rather than you and me.
Well, Glenn, Bernie. I think... Tom, the issue that Glenn is raising is right, is that, you know, we got zillions of television channels, and you got all these radio stations out there, but there is very little discussion about the real issues impacting working families. I was just in a department store last weekend shopping around for some gifts for my grandchildren, and I was looking at a lot of the DVDs there, almost nothing or virtually nothing about the history of this country. You know, all kinds of games about how you can kill people and all that stuff, but very little, nothing, frankly, about the history of our country. So we have, I think, if Glenn's point is that as a nation, we have to understand our own history, how we have evolved, our historical strengths, our historical weaknesses, understand where we are today, have a serious discussion as a nation. Our middle class is collapsing. End of discussion. Gap between the rich and the poor, growing much wider. We have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. What do we do about that? How do we expand the middle class? I hear very little public discussion about that. Most of the media stuff is gossip. It is speculation. It is this candidate, that candidate. But we need to do a lot of public education about where we've come from, where we are, how do we go forward in a sensible way.
Amen. Brilliant. Oh, as always, Senator Sanders, thank you so much for joining us, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great having you on. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the second hour of our program. Well, this is fascinating. Yeah, we had Tom Hayden on our program, what, 2 weeks ago? He was also on a few days ago, but it seems like it was maybe a week and a half ago or so. And he said President Obama is going to get all the troops out of Iraq before the end of the year. He has to do that. And then he came back on again a couple of days ago and said, I'm getting all kinds of blowback from people. Everybody's saying, no, it can't be. And yesterday, it might have been the day before, he published a piece in The Nation magazine saying this is going to happen. Count on it. And he was still getting harassed about it. So President Obama today just held a press conference at the White House. And this was following a video, private video conference with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. And he said, and I quote, this is the President of the United States, "As promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, the war in Iraq will be over. Today I can say the troops in Iraq will be home for the holidays." Additionally, he says we're going to have a strong and enduring partnership with Iraq after the pullout of the troops. I think this is marvelous news. I mean, here's this guy. How can this, the press that Obama gets, some excellent commentary on Daily Kos, on Fire Dog Lake, on Democratic Underground, on Truth Out, on Common Dreams, right across the board, BuzzFlash.com. The progressive websites today pointing out that the headlines, the chyrons, this is the text down at the bottom of the screen, on the TV shows, when last night the Republicans filibustered President Obama's jobs bill that would have said, okay, you've got this great big pile of cookies. Anybody who makes $1 million a year or more, and we're talking about somebody who actually not just has $1 million, because there's actually a fair number of people in America who have a net worth of $1 million because they got a house worth a couple hundred thousand, they got some money in a savings account, they got some IRAs, whatnot. Technically, they're millionaires, but what we're talking about here are people who actually get a paycheck that in 1 year equals $1 million or more. So they're making, $80,000, $90,000 a month or more. And he said, we're not even going to tax that first $1 million, any additional taxes. Won't be a change. But if they make $2 million, they're going to pay an extra 0.5% on that second million, which would be what, about $5,000, I think, if I'm doing my math right, maybe $50,000, I don't, whatever it is, 0.5%. And the Republicans last night said no, but the chyrons and all the TV stations didn't say Republicans block Obama's job bill or Republicans filibuster jobs bill. Instead, they said, and network after network after network did this, Senate rejects Obama's bill. Now, it's true, Ben Nelson, who is a Democrat, arguably, and Joe Lieberman, who is not a Democrat, he is an independent. It should say Joe Lieberman, parentheses, instead of, you know, R or D or even I for independent, it should say Joe Lieberman, parentheses, C, like crackpot party, close parentheses. But anyhow, Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson, frankly, Ben Nelson should be part of the crackpot party, too, voted against the president, against the Democrats, and handed the Republicans the talking point of, well, you don't even have all your own people. But he did have more than 50. He had 52 votes in the Senate for this thing. So, it, you know, if the Republicans had not chosen to filibuster, it would have passed last night. And you'd have 400,000, and it was specific, police officers, firefighters, and teachers, 400,000 who would continue to have jobs for the next year or who would be added, depending on the state, because the money would be administered by the states. In some cases, they're at risk of losing their jobs. In some cases, they need to be hired. 400,000 jobs, and the only people impacted would be fewer than probably 10 or 20,000 people in the United States who have an income of over $1 million a year. That's the constituency of every single Republican in the United States Senate, plus Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson. But the, you know, tragically, I mean, here's the president. He has done these incredible things. He killed bin Laden. He set off the Arab Spring by going to Egypt and saying, tear down these dictators. And they did. He's ending the war in Iraq. He has fundamentally transformed our healthcare system in a way that, you know, it's going to take a few years to phase in, but we are moving in the right direction, particularly when the waivers for the states kick in, so that Vermont and Montana can do their single payer systems, and I think that's going to go viral just like it did in Canada when Saskatchewan first did it. The president has done so many very good things. Yeah, I don't like his trade policies. I can give you a list there too, but. But look at this. These, and the media doesn't even acknowledge it. The Democrats aren't doing a good job of messaging it. I hope I'm sharing it adequately. I mean, it is important, I think, to point out where we would like things improved. But, hey, there's a difference between the circular firing squad and the wind behind your back. And particularly with the Supreme Court at stake in the next election, there is going to be so much money coming in from the Republican side. It's going to be mind-boggling. So George Bush gets a guy to fly him onto an aircraft carrier and comes out, you know, with his outfit, you know, does a stunt in front of a mission accomplished sign on the USS Abraham Lincoln back in 2003. And it's like, you know, wall-to-wall coverage for days. President Obama ends the war in Iraq. We'll see how it gets covered. But anyway, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Let's pick up some of your calls here. Anything goes Friday. Fran in Frisco, Texas. Hey, Fran, what's up?
Hi. Yes. Tom, thank
yes.
you for being there for the American people.
Well, thank you. The thanks are not necessary.
Thank
we
you.
Can just get right
okay.
to the topic.
Okay. Two things. I have family in Wisconsin, and because of the Scott Walker, my cousin and my sister-in-law do not know if they're going to have a job come the next fall.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And I know. I'm going to go up on November 15th to help my aunt get petitions signed to get him recalled, and hopefully that works.
Yeah,
and that'll be a good thing. The other comment I do have to make, and I know you did talk about it before the call got to me, but we talked about the Jobs Bill Act.
Mm.
I have a lot of friends here in Frisco, Texas, and I know Texas is primarily a conservative state, but there are a lot more Democrats and progressives than you think.
You're right.
Okay, in Texas.
I know it.
And
I hear from.
Okay.
Him. Yeah.
Good deal. So, Tom, like I'm a 10-year-old, because you did, you know, talk about the Jobs Bill Act, but like I'm a 10-year-old, if I were to explain this to a 10-year-old, what is it in this Senate dominated by Republican Party that they refuse to pass this Jobs Bill Act, which is a
they want
thing.
People. Here's the simple answer, because we're out of time. I'm sorry, Fran. The simple answer is they want people to be in as much pain as possible come November 2012, because people in pain tend to vote the bums out of office, and they will think of President Obama as one of those bums because they're in pain. This is an election strategy by the Republicans.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Cliff Schechter is going to drop by, the National Progressive PR strategist. Some interesting things going on in Ohio. Stick around.
Now I don't know any time to explain, but it seems like things are just kind of insane, because the world is crying and nobody's listening, so please leave a message on my cell phone. I see.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And it is Anything Goes Friday. We will continue taking your calls just a second, though. But first, I wanted to check in with my old friend and a very astute political analyst, Cliff Schechter. He's a national progressive PR strategist, Libertas LLC, also nationally syndicated columnist for Al Jazeera English, and the author of the book The Real McCain. His website, LibertasLLC.com. Cliff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Tom. How are you, man?
Great, great. I understand, you know, you live in Ohio, and your previous governor had written, correct me if I have these details wrong, but I think this is it. I'd love to hear your take on this, and also to know what people in Ohio think about this. Your previous governor had issued an executive order regulating exotic animal farms, pens, whatever the right word is, sanctuaries. And Governor Kasich decided, we don't need no stinking regulations. This is inconsistent with Republican philosophy. Screw the regulations. And now you have a very interesting problem in your state.
Yeah, all of that was exactly right, especially the Republican, obviously, their philosophy of no regulation can be a good one, this zealous, really insane philosophy we've had since Reagan. Government's always on your back, and it's always better to get it off. So in this case, you're exactly right. Governor Strickland before passed an executive order that was strict in how these animals were going to be cared for, sold and cared for on these private farms, private compounds. And John Kasich came in, the teabag governor came in and was elected and said it would hurt small businesses. You know, they always use the same line. So he, of course, let this expire, and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources had no jurisdiction over these farms and regulating them. So what ended up happening, of course, is, you know, they don't know how many of them there are. They don't know what conditions they're in. What did happen is this is a guy that had been convicted of illegally possessing a firearm. He's a guy who had been cited for animal abuse numerous times, and still he was allowed to operate this farm with 56 animals on it. And probably most people at this point know what happened, which is before killing himself, he released all of them, 49 of which ended up having to be killed. You know, Bengal tigers, 18 of them. There are only 1,400 or so in the entire world. I mean, it's sickening and it's heartbreaking, but it's also a broader story about where we are. I mean, I wrote just sort of column, you know, where I kind of tied drew a line between that and what's going on in Wall Street with Occupy Wall Street now because of the repealed Glass-Steagall and other ridiculous deregulation on Wall Street, and what's going on with this birth control pill now, Yaz. I think you've had Mike Papantonio on your show.
Yeah, we did yesterday.
Talk about that and how these women are 630% more likely to get embolisms, and it's all the same thing. It's all that was barely a response from the Democratic side, sadly. These guys, even after what happened on Wall Street, which is insane to me, you know, after 2007, they still talk about deregulation like it's a good thing, like it's better for all of us, like we don't all end up sharing the much higher costs when tragedy ensues, whether it's a person's health or it's the animals released, you know, out, and so we're lucky nobody was killed, or anything else. It's just, it's crazy, and we're still living, it seems, under this paradigm.
Yeah, and what astounds me, Cliff, is I get conservatives on this show, and, you know, to debate the issues. And I say, okay, so what's the Republican job plan? And they say, well, the Republican job plan is to cut regulations and to kill off Obamacare. And I'm like, okay, so really the Republican job plan is to make more people sick so that so we're going to hire more doctors and nurses eventually?
I guess so, right? I mean, I guess in the end, when more people are sick from that, when my kids get lead poisoning because they don't want to regulate products being sent in from China.
Right, you'll have to hire a neurologist.
Exactly. I mean, I guess that's the job plan, right? Well, it's going to be a great boon for the nursing industry and maybe for psychiatrists and psychologists out there. But, I mean, in all honesty, I mean, you know, we all pay the price. When somebody doesn't have health insurance, ends up in an emergency room because they didn't get preventative care, we all pay the price of that. What happened the other night, I mean, to me, just it's repugnant on a compassionate level. I happen to be an animal lover, and so it sickens me. But even if you want to view everything the way the Republicans do, just through a purely economic lens, you know, what productivity is lost by police out there chasing around animals, shooting them? You know, how is that beneficial economically? You know, what this gentleman was doing? It's insanity. And of course, we know there's cases like that, and then there's the broader cases, like what's going on with Wall Street, which essentially has destroyed the economy for a number of years. But they're still doing this, and they're still getting away with it, and it's just amazing to me. It's amazing. It's one of those three or four things that literally drives me crazy. The Democrats can't look them in the face in any debate or any argument and say, are you really? I mean, you're really arguing for less regulation after the last couple of years. Are you crazy? You know, I just don't. I don't get it. I don't get it, Tom.
It's sort of like, you know, the libertarians, the Ron Paul people, who believe that if all regulations were done away with, that we would live in a utopian world. I don't you think, Cliff, that some of them are actually kind of utopianist idealists and secret libertarians, and have this fantasy that if we just become like Somalia, somehow we will self-organize instantly, or the billionaires will take care of us, and that probably a larger cohort of the Republicans are just saying this because it's the only thing they can say because they're in the bag of the billionaires and the giant corporations. And not all billionaires, by the way, are toxic like this. I mean, there's some very, very good, you know, very wealthy people out there. But you've got a small number of them, and particularly the Koch brothers, who are just driving this crazy train.
Right. And I don't think your point could be more right on. I think most of them just do it because it benefits their economic, their funders, and so they don't know it. They probably don't know the effects of any of the deregulation they advocate for. I don't think they take the time to care. They just do it because they're being paid off to do it in a system of legalized bribery that we have. But yes, there are a certain group of libertarians, and you hit the nail on the head. You know, it's like the communists used to be attacked for wanting to create this utopia that just made no common sense. I mean, really, if they think you remove all government regulations and we're all going to organize peacefully, I mean, there won't be warlords that will take large chunks of things. There won't be corporations that will become monopolies. We'll all just sit around.
It'll be a mess. It'll just be a mess. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Cliff. Good talking with you today.
I appreciate it, Tom.
We'll catch up with you again. We'll be back with more Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option. And given anything goes, Mike in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. Just a quick comment. I'd love to see you on Keith Olbermann. The thing I wanted to talk about was I'm a staunch agnostic. A couple of weeks ago on your RT program, you had a discussion with the guy who wrote The God Delusion. And
right. Richard Dawkins. He was also on this radio program. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That was a really great conversation you had with him. And he has sort of tipped me a little bit more into the atheist direction. I thought his reasoning was very good. And I'd like to see a real movement, agnostic/atheist movement in this country.
Well, if you accept the general definitions that an atheist is a person who is certain that there is no God, and an agnostic is a person who's not sure whether there is or isn't or what it all is, and you know, pretty much doesn't have an opinion or their opinion is that they don't know. then Richard Dawkins is clearly an atheist. He's, in fact, he's a I believe the leader of or founder of or on the board of the Atheist Society in the United Kingdom, and it's got a name something like that. And the question that I didn't ask Richard Dawkins that I always wish that, you know, in retrospect I wished I had, was, isn't it inconsistent with the scientific model as a scientist to say that you are absolutely certain that he went beyond just saying there's no God. I mean, you know, the idea, a lot of people, it's very easy to say that the Bronze Age God, you know, some old guy with a long beard who keeps a record book about everything you do, and if you perform the right rituals on the certain holidays, then he scratches things out of the book and produces amnesia about your sins and stuff like that. You know, that part, you know, he's repudiating, but he even goes so far as to say all spirituality, anything that's supernatural, he completely repudiates. And isn't the scientific model always keep an open mind, wait for more information?
I'm glad you bring that up, because when people say that I'm really a closet atheist, I tell them, look, I'm an agnostic because there's no way to know for sure.
Right.
I'm not an atheist because it's bad science.
Yeah, and that's why I say, and I know that I'll get another 1,000 pieces of hate mail when I say this, but why I say that agnosticism is not a religion. Atheism, when it becomes evangelical, as Richard Dawkins does, when people go out and they try to convert other people to their belief system, and it is a belief system, it lacks absolute proof, just like the religions lack absolute proof, it's a religion. That atheism, evangelical atheism, is a religion. Agnosticism, in my opinion, is not. And non-evangelical, quiet atheism is a personal religion, but it's not an institutionalized one. But there's people out there, you know, who are trying to create this institutional religion. Penteller, for example, and others. So, anyway, Ed in Redondo Beach. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I've been sending good thoughts your way because, you know, hey, we all could use it. And
you betcha.
Listen, I went down to my local Occupy protest here in L.A. to see what was going on. And one of the things I noticed is that there's definitely a strong feeling that Obama's in the tank for the banksters, just like the Republicans. And, you know, it's a feeling that gets underscored by things like the report on MSNBC last night that the Obama and the DNC have raised more Wall Street money than all the Republican candidates combined. And it occurs to me that, you know, if the president wants to get in front of this 99% parade, he's going to have to do something more than just flog budget packages that cannot pass the Republican Congress no matter what. He's going to, because that's just kabuki theater. You know, he's going to have to actually do something that is substantive and real. And the one thing that crosses my mind that he can do that the Republicans can't run interference on is do a little house cleaning in his own cabinet and get rid of Tim Geithner and all the second tier Goldman Sachs people in his cabinet and replace them with credible progressive economists like Paul Krugman and Robert Reich and Joseph Stigler and Ravi Batra and people like that. Cause, that's something that is in his control. It's something that he can do. And, you know, I think most people are hip to the fact that the Republicans are not going to give him anything he wants in terms of, you know, jobs.
And increasingly, Wall Street is not giving him what he wants. Wall Street has become the major funder of the Romney campaign. They are not the major funder of the Obama campaign. They were a large funder, and it's actually people who work on Wall Street, not Wall Street itself. Although now with Citizens United, it could be Wall Street corporations themselves, and we'll never know. But their major, you know, the Wall Street is a major funder of Karl Rove's efforts. And so, you know, none of which is on the radar screen. But your point, I think your point is well taken. And I was really encouraged yesterday by the conversation with Ron Suskind, where he said that, and he's interviewed Obama at length and everybody in the Obama White House for his new book. And he said, you know, I said, do you think that if Obama is reelected, he will become the FDR that he had the opportunity to be in, you know, in his first term and kind of missed on the advice of people like Summers and Geithner. And then when he actually was going to try and, you know, take some names and kick some ass over at Bank of America, and he said to Tim Geithner, put together a plan to nationalize Bank of America. We're going to take them down and show the rest of the banks that we mean business, which really would have been the perfect thing to do. Tim Geithner said, yes, Mr. President, I'll do that. And then he never got around to it. Months later,
he did the slow walk. Yeah.
Yeah. Months later, Obama says, "Okay, where's the plan? It's time to implement this thing." And Geithner's, "Oh, we never got around to it." At that point, I would have said, "Hey, buddy, you're out of here." And I suspect. Now, you know, I think that President Obama is getting it. He gets the populist rage. He gets the Occupy Wall Street. It's taken him a while to shake off the advisor haze.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it. The bubble.
And he wants to send a signal. Changing the people that he runs with is.
Well, I think that's the first one, and the second one that you're going to see is that he's going to be bringing prosecutions against Wall Street. I think that sometime between now and the election, we're going to see some significant prosecutions of banksters, and just like we're seeing the end of the war in Iraq, because it's what the people want. And you can say, and there are people out there who are saying, "Oh, well, that's just politics. He's just doing that to get reelected." And my answer to that is, and that's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to do what the people want. And if our elected officials do what the people want, then we reelect them. I mean, that's how it's supposed to work. And so, you know, we can relitigate the past 3 years. I don't think there's a lot of value in it. I think that he is moving forward in a very positive direction, and we'll see. I mean, that's you know, as Mike Dirks, my old mentor at KPOJ in Portland and famous Zen master says, "We'll see." Jason in Washington D.C. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, you know, I was just going to point out, you know, Bernie Sanders, when he was talking earlier about money and campaigns, you don't have, the number one thing that both parties fear is a third person running in a race. There've been a number of economics, and basically, what happens is when a third person runs in a race, money is no object in terms of the deciding outcome.
Well, it depends on the third person.
And, you know, you got to understand, you know, everybody loves it, you know, when like Ross Perot wins, because basically Ross Perot, you know, caused Bill Clinton to win.
You could make that argument. You could also make the argument that Ross Perot, you know, it diminished the size of Bill Clinton's victory, because Bill Clinton was running as a progressive when he ran. I mean, he didn't govern so much as one. But his New Covenant speech was ripped right out of the pages of FDR.
Okay. Everybody was on Ralph Nader's ass when he ran. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is you have to really look into these ballot access laws. I've run multiple times as an independent candidate, mm-hmm. and I got to let you know, the system's completely rigged
by the two-party system. No, you're absolutely right, Jason.
They hear it beyond you know, and that's why we're sitting here, we're talking about.
This is why we need instant runoff voting in this country, because we're one of only seven democracies out of the 100 or so in the world that doesn't have proportional representation, that doesn't have a situation where if 20% of the voters vote for party A, party A gets 20% of the seats. If 6% vote for party B, party B gets 6% of the seats. We have a winner-take-all system. And what that does is it produces automatically a two-party system. It creates a duopoly. And then those two parties over time become kind of calcified and ossified until people get so fed up with things that they start, you know, that you have revolt movements within the parties. And we saw that with the Tea Party taking over the Republican Party. And frankly, I think the Occupy Wall Street movement and the progressive movement is starting to take over the Democratic Party. The largest caucus in Congress right now is the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives. That's a really, really, really good sign. So if you want third parties and if you want success and if you want to move in that direction, the way to do that is to support instant runoff voting. And at the local level, it's the Green Party that's out there pushing it. We need to get the Democratic Party pushing it. I know they're scared to death of it. We need to get them pushing it. Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania. We have a minute to the break. Randy, it's all yours. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. About a month ago, you touched on a law that Roosevelt signed into being in the 30s.
Yeah.
It prohibited all imports unless they paid a very high tariff. If it could be made here, was made here.
Well, this is called the Buy American Act, but it was only for things purchased by the federal government. Yes.
Oh.
The original tariff, the larger tariff act that you're talking about was actually passed by George Washington in 1783 based on Alexander Hamilton's report on manufacturers. It's in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, if you want all the background and the details. And that was law from 1783 all the way through the 19th century, all the way through the 20th century until Reagan became president. He started dismantling it, and then Bill Clinton really took it apart with NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO. But Reagan stopped enforcing the 1933 Buy American Act that said that the federal government purchases have to be domestically manufactured. And that's 20% of our economy is government purchases. So that would have a huge impact if the president would just enforce the law that's on the books.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Coming up next, the Talk Radio News Service will check in with all the news of the day, and we'll continue taking your calls here on Anything Goes Friday. Well, I realize we're a day late, Victoria Jones, of the Talk Radio News Service, but you're not older, you're better.
Thank you, and you're not a dollar short. Yes, yes.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Yesterday was my birthday, and it only comes around once a year. So I take a staggered approach, you know, because being the only member of my family on the continent, I believe in just extending it.
Okay. So. There you go.
What I do.
Okay. So what's going on in the world?
Well, a little less than an hour ago, President Barack Obama came out to the Brady Press briefing room and said, I can report that as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
Yeah, this is a big deal.
He said a number of things. One quotation I've got recorded is, today I can say that our troops in Iraq will definitely be home for the holidays.
Now, that's interesting because, Tom Hayden has been saying for a couple of weeks now that Obama's going to bring all the troops home by the end of the year. But he suggested that in all probability, Obama would simply relocate them to like Doha or, you know, someplace else in the region where if things get bad in Iraq, they can be rapidly redeployed back. Do you think that this was just a rhetorical flourish, or is he actually intending to bring them back to the United States?
They're coming home. He said, over the next 2 months, our troops in Iraq, tens of thousands of them, will pack up their gear and board convoys for the journey home. The last American soldier will cross the border out of Iraq with their heads held high, proud of their success and knowing that the American people stand united in our support for our troops. Because the U.S. and the Iraqis were not able to work out a deal over immunity.
Right.
This is a question that I asked Jay Carney last week, a question, by the way, that nobody else in the briefing room had any interest in asking, I have to point out, because everybody else thought it was really boring.
I think this is the key to the whole thing.
It was the key to the whole thing, because the U.S. always wants immunity for its troops when it stays in another country. In other words, that basically from prosecution in Iraqi courts. And the Americans refused to stay without it. And the Iraqis said, well, no, you can't have it. So they started negotiating about it, and they've been negotiating for a long time with a fairly fractured Iraqi government that can't really agree on what kind of bagels they're going to send out for.
Yeah.
So it's a problem. And then, then they were disagreeing on numbers and everything. And it's October the 21st. It was becoming increasingly less likely that they could really work this out. And then the president and Prime Minister al-Maliki did have a video conference call and agreed that they couldn't work this out. But it leaves them both able to declare victory.
Yes. Yeah, it does. And frankly, I think for those in the anti-war movement and for those of us who oppose the original occupation, the invasion, and now this, 9 year occupation of Iraq, I see it as a very positive thing. By the way, bagels are kind of New York. Did you know that the croissant actually began in the region where Iraq is?
This is the crescent.
Yes, it was the crescent. Exactly. And so anybody who's eating croissants is eating the Muslim symbol, and so somebody should tell that to the Republican members of Congress who love to eat in fancy restaurants where they serve croissants, and maybe Peter King will launch an investigation.
Maybe they will.
Anyway, what else is going on?
Well, it's an interesting story because it has some sort of knock on effects also. Mm-hmm. Because the question then is raised, do these troops stay home or do they in fact get deployed elsewhere? The president then talked a little bit about the economy, talked about the domestic concern that's going to determine whether he wins re-election next year, saying after a decade of of war. The nation that we need to build and the nation that we will build is our own, an America that sees its economic strength restored just as we've restored our leadership around the globe. He also took the opportunity to talk about how we need to treat our veterans when they come home. So he talked about that also.
Right.
So he touched on everything, basically. Well, other things that are going on, interesting, of course, now that the House has been on recess all this week, as you know, then the Senate tore out of here. You could see the cabs basically tearing off to the airports because they're out next week, which basically means that nothing gets done. And some people say, well, that's great. The less damage Congress does, the better, except for one thing, November the 18th. Stopgap spending resolution looming.
Right, because there has been no budget passed forever, and so everything has been continuing resolutions.
Right, and they've got a dozen appropriations bills that they have to pass. And they haven't passed very many of them. In fact, the Senate's only passed a few. The House has passed a few. Everybody's pointing fingers at everybody else. The Senate's been really sort of dilatory, actually. And then the Senate's off next week, so the House can point fingers at it all week, and they're certainly not planning to come back. They're going to take their week. So everybody's only back now at the beginning of November, which leaves very little time to get it all done when you've got a dozen appropriation bills. So what they've been talking about is what they call minibuses, where they've got the bills bundled into three bills at a time. That's very complicated because the bills don't always make sense. You might have bills regarding, I don't know, feeding cats, the war in Afghanistan, and bleach.
Right.
And so they don't, you know, they don't make sense.
Yeah.
So what they're now talking about is possibly doing an omnibus spending bill.
Which they've done in the past, is what they typically do. Yeah.
But there are key party Republicans in the House who are philosophically opposed to an omnibus spending bill, and John Boehner has spoken against that in the past.
Right. In fact, they ran against that. One of their items, one of the Tea Party articles of faith, is that all appropriations legislation should be specific, you know, line item, basically. You know, each bill should be about its own thing.
Right. So that might run up against some problems as well. So we could see this coming back to haunt us once again.
And in this case, rather than it being a political whack upside the head of President Obama by the Republicans, it would be the Tea Partiers going after John Boehner?
Yes, and John Boehner having to decide what he's going to do. Is he going to side with the Tea Partiers, or what does he do? Because nobody's passed the bills.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a conservative alert. Cantor cancels inequality speech after he discovers it's open to the public. OWS was going to show up.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. This is absolutely our conservative alert for the day. Absolutely incredible. Eric Cantor has been taking some heat. You know, the number two Republican in the House of Representatives, he actually represents a district in Virginia, just down the road from here in Washington, D.C. And he's been taking a lot of heat because he won't have open meetings. He won't have public meetings. He won't talk to his constituents. He only has these, like, closed private meetings, you know, by invitation only meetings, so that he knows that there won't be any embarrassing moments and there won't be any bad videotape that comes out. And nobody will ask him, are you really trying to bring down President Obama? Why don't you care about people's jobs? You know, those kinds of things. Well, Eric Cantor today, pretty much right now, this afternoon, middle of the afternoon, it was supposed to give a speech at the University of Pennsylvania. And he signed on for a speech in front of what is referred to as a, quote, selected audience, end quote. In other words, Eric Cantor, you know, the deal that they had cut was that the audience would be people that his people could select. And then the university, I mean, universities tend to be fairly democratic institutions, and the university got together and they said, there's something wrong with this. if he's going to speak to the University of Pennsylvania, he should speak to, you know, it should be open to the public. And so they opened it to the public. And so the folks at Occupy Philadelphia said, you know, the Philadelphia branch of Occupy Wall Street, the folks at Occupy Philadelphia said, cool, it's open to the public. Let's go hear Eric Cantor give a speech. Now, you know how the neocons used to be the be afraid. Look out, those Muslims are going to come and get you, whatever. And they succeeded in terrifying a lot of Republicans. I know that the message of the 1% is not be afraid. But I can tell you, in Eric Cantor's mind, he is. He is. It's like, holy cow, the 99%ers are coming to get us. You know, Eric Cantor, of course, representing only the 1%. So the 99% movement that's in opposition to the 1% having so much, you know, 400 people on the top of the 1% owning more wealth than 150 million Americans. That's who Eric Cantor represents. So he, with literally just a few hours' notice, as soon as the University of Pennsylvania said, we're going to open this thing to the public, and Occupy Philadelphia said, cool, we're going to show up, he said, I won't be there. I'm not going to be there. Not going to do it. Sorry. I got to go have drinks and play golf with John Boehner, you know? Actually, that's not going to happen because these two guys are such incredible competitors. And John Boehner knows that Eric Cantor wants to put the political knife in his back, so he's not going to get that. He's not going to let himself get that close to Eric Cantor without witnesses. But in any case, it's just great political theater. By the way, our old friend Sam from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, who's a regular caller to the show, he called in a little earlier and told Julie, our call screener, and he didn't ask that I pass this along, but I want to pass it along. He just wanted us to know. But I know he won't mind if we pass it along because he announced on the air last week that he had been diagnosed with cancer. His surgery is scheduled for November 1st. So, Sam, if you're watching, you will be in on my prayer list. I'm actually into that. And I hope that, you know, all of our listeners and viewers will send some light your way or some good vibes your way or whatever their respective perspective may be. Sam, we wish you well. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Jack in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I'm going to go slow because I got a few numbers here. Two mornings ago on Democracy Now!, they had an individual on, a man who was being interviewed that worked in the Reagan administration as an investigator of the SNL crimes.
Okay.
Okay, so what he was on to say was the difference between what's going on today in terms of following up leads and the government saying to him and his people that work with him, investigate this, check this out, see what's going on there around high crimes in the financial world. Okay, I just want to give you a couple numbers. Maybe you could check this out, because I think if you knew this and if it's accurate, it's something that you would probably bring forward. During the SNL, there were 1,000 FBI agents working on investigating stuff that the government directed them to investigate. There were 10,000 incidents that they investigated. Who knows how many of those actually
1,600 people were prosecuted, 1,000 went to prison, roughly. We did, back, Bill Seidman, who was actually the head of the Resolution Trust Corporation, the guy who put this all together, he passed away last year. But about 2 or 3 years ago, he gave a speech in Grand Rapids at the commencement of a meeting of a college that he helped form back years and years ago. I mean, he was in his 80s at this point. And a brilliant speech. And Jacob's got a half a dozen clips of it in his clip library. And we devoted almost a week to playing these clips of Bill Seidman telling the story about what they did back in the 80s, how they pulled together how they actually put banksters in jail, how they nationalized the SNLs. They fired the senior management, and they put in bank regulators to run these SNLs. The investors all took a haircut. They got screwed. And that's how it should have been. And this was in the Reagan administration. And over the 30-year lifetime of the Resolution Trust Corporation, by the time they reprivatized those SNLs, the federal government actually made a profit on the deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've been there. We've covered that, Jack. I appreciate the call.
Let me give you just two numbers.
Okay.
Here, Tom,
go for it. Real quick.
He said there were 1,000 agents back in the Reagan days.
Right.
Now there's 170. He claims it's 70 times worse what's going on now, and they've been told not to do one. That's been zero. And right. He's calling for the firing of Geithner, Holder, and that Bernanke should resign,
yeah.
And that Obama needs to start really hammering these guys.
Well, the gossip that you hear in this town, Jack, is fascinating, and I don't know if this is actually going to happen or not. But what I'm hearing is that the FBI actually is aggressively investigating some of these crimes on Wall Street. And certainly you've got, you know, the state of California now has pulled out of originally they were trying to make it a 50 state. Let's cut a deal with the banks to give them immunity. They pay a fine and everybody walks away and nobody goes to jail. State of California just pulled out of that this week. We reported that on this program day before yesterday. And Eric Schneiderman in New York is saying, no way I'm going to go along with that. There are other states who are saying, not going to go along with it. We're going to prosecute the banksters. Eric Schneiderman, I think, is the best bet for that. And Eric Holder, I believe, is going to be between now and the election, is going to start doing this because, you know, Obama gets it that following Bush's Bush established this. You know, the crash really began in 2006. In 2006, on this program, when housing starts dropped 34%, I did a whole long show about how in 1926 housing starts dropped 35%, and the housing bubble that had happened from 1920 to 1936 as a result of President Harding in 1920 dropping the top income tax rate from 90% down to 25%. The housing bubble that had started in Florida had gone nationwide, and that housing bubble burst in 26, and it led to the crash of the stock market in 29. And so in 2006, when the housing bubble was bursting in the United States, I was telling people, there's a crash coming. I think there will be prosecutions.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More with Anything Goes Friday, right after this, 15 minutes past the hour here with Tom Hartman.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Oh, that's our cheesy news alert music. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, announcing that it would be completely withdraw its troops from Iraq by the end of the year. President Obama today maintained that the United States was not deserting Iraq, promising the Iraqi people, "We will continue to follow you on Twitter." Mr. Obama indicated that the United States' relationship with Iraq would soon transition from a military one to a social networking one, with the United States promising to like Iraq's Facebook page and share contact information on LinkedIn. He added, however, that the United States would not have a presence on Google+, quote, because no one else does, end quote. In summing up the United States' 8-year military mission in Iraq, Mr. Obama said, quote, "We have done everything we set out to do in this mission except figure out what the mission was," end of quote. Maybe George Bush knew. I don't know. I still don't know. Turning to Libya, Mr. Obama expressed pride in the successful NATO effort to topple dictator Muammar Gaddafi. He said, "It is my hope that Libya will soon have a functioning democracy and that someday the United States will, too," end of quote. Former Vice President Dick Cheney also congratulated the Libyan people, releasing the following official statement, quote, "With Gaddafi gone, Libya's right to determine its future is now safely in the hands of multinational oil companies," end quote. Thanks, Andy Borowitz. Of course, it's news with tongue firmly planted in cheek, but as is so often the case, there is a pretty amazing little bit of truth in there. Chris in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My question for you today is this. I've been on hold since you went on air 5 minutes because I had a question for Senator Sanders. Why do you say anything goes Friday, but you only let people through to talk to the center and you if they agree with you? Do you not want to hear the opinions of people who disagree with you?
We actually, you know, we have a second phone number, 866-745-CONS, that we used to advertise as our conservative call-in number. We now use that for TV callers. It's also 745-2667. But if you identify yourself to Julie as somebody who disagrees with me, she will put the word disagree on the screen, and you will be my next caller. I always put people who disagree with me on, well, you know, it would depend on what the question was for Bernie.
So it's not anything goes.
It's what people
agree with you goes, and then people who don't agree with you can't talk.
No, not with
free speech to me.
Okay, Chris, how I run my show is not Bruce. Hey, Bruce in Portland, you're on the air. What's up?
Yeah, I'd like to know what did you think about this pervert Hillary Clinton laughing about Gaddafi's death, saying we came, we saw, he died. And I agree with your last caller. This is the most heavily screened show on radio, and everybody knows.
Okay, Bruce, it's just simply not true. Unless you are drunk or abusive to Julie. Actually, there's a small cadre of crazies who call Julie and constantly swear at her and make sexual references to her and things. And, yes, those people are screened out. Chris in Vancouver. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to talk about the Occupy. I see people getting arrested and stuff like that, and it's just I'm trying to find a job right now, or I've been kind of lucky, underemployed or whatever. But I've been up for jobs, and my record, it's a misdemeanor record. It happened 5 years ago, but it disbars me from a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm just seeing these people get arrested. They're thinking they're doing something, but when they go to try to find some job, they go, oh, well, that protest you got arrested for, it. Well, we can't have you work here.
Yeah. Hopefully, by the time, you know, I think that we are very much at a time of social change and social transformation in this country. And hopefully by the time that happens, which I think is going to be in the next 2 to 3 years, that those kinds of issues will be minimized. But you're absolutely right. Right now, employers are screening people based on whether or not they have a criminal background, in quotes, and some even include misdemeanors. Some simply say, have you ever been arrested? I mean, you know, it used to be illegal to actually ask that question. It had to be, have you ever been convicted? But that law went by the books. And, you know, so the protections that potential employees have are gone, or to a largely gone. And frankly, I think they need to be brought back. Excellent point, Chris. Thank you very much for making it. Joanne in North Hollywood, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Joanne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'd like to know why, or maybe you can give me the stats on people who are here illegally that are non-Latinos. In other words, we stopped the Latinos, or they stopped the Latinos for ID or whatever. But are the Irish? Where are the Italians? Where are the Russians, the Serbs, the this, the that? Where is that happening? I mean, we have millions and millions of illegals from other countries.
Yeah, we do.
But we never hear – I'm sorry.
No, you're absolutely right. We do. And, in fact, the vast majority of people who are here illegally didn't cross the Mexican border. Well, actually, I shouldn't say the vast majority. Probably the vast majority did now. But historically, the vast majority of people who are here illegally are people who come on tourist visas and just overstay their visas. And that was the case with all of the 9/11 people. They came on either student visas or tourist visas. So, and there are enforcement actions being taken against those people. And there have been for years and years. I remember when I was in college, a friend of mine was here from the UK. He dropped out of college. He was no longer legal on his visa. He's still here in the United States somewhere. I saw him a couple of years ago at one of the get-togethers, and the INS is still looking for him. So it's like, you know, so
he probably won't be stopped because is he...
He looks Caucasian. Yeah, I mean, he looks, yeah. And so, and that's the racist element of that. That makes it easier for those kinds of illegal immigrants than for illegal immigrants who have dark skin. You're absolutely right. And there's not much conversation about that. The other reason why there's not much conversation about that is I'm just guessing is not quite the right word. I would nearly bet on this, but I would say that there's very few people in Europe who really desperately want, so desperately want to be in the United States that they're willing to come here illegally and take the risks associated with that. Because life isn't all that bad in Europe. And whereas that's very much not the case in Africa, South America, Central America, Mexico. So we don't have, and so I'd say that the quote problem, as it were, of immigrants from those countries is less.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very disticophobically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray, while pulling people over and asking them for immigration papers, is becoming the rage all around the country, and particularly in red states. Washington, D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray won't let it happen in the nation's capital. Gray signed an executive order prohibiting officers from asking any questions about immigration status during arrests and other operations. Gray cited the need for people to feel comfortable when cooperating with the police. He also said his city is, quote, not going to be an instrument of enforcing federal law when it comes to immigration, end of quote. Good move. The bad. Senator Jeff Sessions, the Republican from Alabama, wants to take food out of the mouths of poor people. More people depend on the food stamps program than ever before since George W. Bush's banksters blew a hole in the economy and 30 years of Reaganomics stopped working people's wages from growing. Senator Sessions is now introducing legislation to cut funding for food stamps and making it harder for people to get assistance. He said in defense of his bill, we cannot do this. We do not have the money. He might as well have said, let them go dumpster diving. And the very, very ugly Phil Mitch. Politicians love giving their advice on a whole variety of things, from tax policy to how best to create jobs. Republican New Jersey Senate candidate Phil Mitch should have kept his own particular piece of advice to himself. How women can keep their men from cheating on them. On Wednesday, Mitch sent out a doozy of a tweet saying, quote, women, you increase your odds of keeping your men by being faithful, a lady in the living room and a whore in the bedroom, end quote. Mitch has since apologized for offending anyone, particularly women, for his tweet, though I'll be surprised if he still remains a Republican candidate for office by next week. Here's some advice for Mitch. If you want to increase your odds of getting elected, be knowledgeable about the issue and don't use that word in reference to women. It's just very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Ron in Orange County, California, listening on KTLK. Ron, thanks so much for being on hold for almost an hour and hopefully for not complaining about it.
No problem at all. I have a question for you, Tom, and actually a shameless plug, if I might. My question is, why is it that no one has challenged Rick Perry in the state of Texas on these job creation numbers that they're presenting? I submit to you that these are not jobs that were created by Texas. These were jobs that were transferred to Texas. Texas simply had the best bid, a better bid than other states. I mean, even here in the state of California, companies closed their companies and transferred them to Texas.
Right.
So they were not job creations. They were job transfers.
At a national level, if you're looking at the level of the nation, if you're looking at the level of the state, of course, the state views it as jobs. And that's how Perry always frames it. And you're absolutely right. Somebody needs to be pointing that out. The problem is the Republicans love the fact that states are able to play off against each other, because what it does is it drives down the labor market. And the Democrats have not yet engaged the Republicans. My guess is that if Rick Perry were the Republican candidate, the nominee, which there's no way he's going to be, but were he the Republican nominee, that would be one of the very first things that President Obama would go after him on. But the reason why he hasn't been challenged on that is because the only people challenging him right now are Republicans, and they all love the idea. You know, they're all right in the same place. You know, yes, let the states compete against each other. I'm with Bernie Sanders, who suggested that any state that engages in competition with other states by offering, you know, lower wages or discounts, tax discounts or free land or anything like that, that state should lose their federal highway funds. Let's just put an end to this race to the bottom.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah. Okay. Ron, thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Shameless plug?
Pardon?
Shameless plug?
Sure. Go for it.
Please check out this website, www.peoples-party.org.
Okay.
Peoples-party.org.
Okay, your plug. I'm not familiar with it, but Ron, good luck. Thanks a lot for the call. Yasmin in Tacoma, Washington, who's also been on hold almost an hour. Yasmin, thank you very much for your call. And what's up?
Yeah, I had a question about the the Supreme Court of Justice, the judges sitting there. Why is that they don't have a term? Why is that they sit there for the rest of their lives? I mean, you sit in a job forever, then you're going to feel like you own that job and nobody can tell you anything, and that's the problem. In the Middle East, that's what's happening in the Middle East. That these dictators sit there forever, and then they feel like nobody's going to get me out of this.
Right, and they become increasingly less accountable to the people. When the founders put together the Constitution, they believed that there needed to be, because there were two branches of government that were regularly responsive to the people and regularly turning over, there were people among the founders, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, most prominent among them, who didn't actually trust the people, who felt that there needed to be permanent institutions in the United States. Hamilton, in fact, proposed that the president should be a lifetime position. And he was hooted out. He was so embarrassed by the response that he got that he left the Constitutional Convention, went to New York for a month and sulked before he came back. But the compromise for that was lifetime appointments for the Supreme Court. And the idea was that would make them independent of political influence. It hasn't worked out that way, obviously. And frankly, I think needs to be reconsidered. And there is a mechanism for reconsidering it. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court shall operate under rules established. Hang it just a half a second. I'll give you the exact language. Established by Article. Here it is. Under such regulations as the Congress shall make. And, you know, and frankly, you know, back during the Roosevelt administration, FDR was playing with a regulation which he could legally have passed, which said that whenever a justice reached the age of 70, he was no longer an active justice. He was a justice emeritus and he didn't have a vote. He could still sit on the court, but he didn't have a vote. And it's referred to as FDR's court packing scheme. It blew up in his face politically, although probably that had more to do with how he did it than what it was, because I think a lot of people sympathized with it. But that's the rationale, Yasmin, unless we amend the Constitution or unless Congress takes action, as FDR tried to get them to do unsuccessfully, it's not going to change. Thank you very much for the call, though, and thanks for waiting on hold. Albert in Friendship, Wisconsin. Hey, Albert, what's up?
All right. I got a question basically about Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we can get him recalled, can they replace the voter ID?
Replace the voter ID. That's actually a piece of legislation. Not being a Wisconsinite, I don't know if that was passed as a law or as an amendment to the Constitution. I'm pretty sure it's just a law.
Yeah, it's a law that he passed, but I was wondering if we can get him kicked out.
Right.
And the guy that would step in his place, could he switch it back the way it used to be?
No. No, it would take an act of the legislature, the Senate and the House. And the Senate and the House are both still controlled by Republicans. It's still Fitz Walker Stan. And the two Fitzgerald brothers running the House and the Senate, both Republicans in Wisconsin. And then you've got Scott Walker as the governor. So, no, that can't be undone. It might be undone by federal court action. The Justice Department is looking at whether it's illegal or not. Tragically, no. It's a good try, Albert. And the sad thing is that this is legislation that came out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is a bunch of corporations who pay $100,000 or more to be members to write legislation that they then give to Republican lawmakers. There's a couple of token Democrats, but they're virtually all Republicans. They represent about a third of all state legislators in the country. They give these laws written by corporations to these guys at the state level and say, pass this in your state legislature, and they do. And they do regularly, in fact. It's really shocking. Let's see, J.D. in Napa, California. Hey, J.D., what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for everything. I just wanted to make a comment about that last caller. In my lobbying, old-time lobbying days, one of the comments was simply this. We'd be better off if we pay these people to stay home and never write a piece of legislation, simply because every time they do, they screw up our lives. And that was our inside joke.
Yeah.
But what I'm calling about...
You're talking about lobbyists writing legislation or legislators?
The legislators.
Yeah, that's been kind of the Republican mantra for a long time. I don't go along with that. I think the biggest problem is that over 90% of the legislation now being introduced both at the federal and state legislative levels... are being written by corporations and lobbyists, yes.
That's exactly right. That's why it's all wrong.
Yep.
And that's why the system's broken. But meanwhile, what I'm really excited about is I'm very excited about my President Barack Obama, who has ended the war in Iraq. And that is what he said he would do before I became on board with him when he was running for office. That is why, the biggest why I voted for him. And he has done what I voted for him to do. Now, the rest of this mess that we have to take care of, this was on the plate after he became president, after he was elected. We didn't know about this stuff. The Bushies blindsided America and the rest of the world.
Well, he knew about Afghanistan and was gung-ho to go in there, but I think that he's learning the lesson that Afghanistan is unwinnable, too, and he's looking for solutions out of that. It's just a lot more complicated because Karzai is so weak, at least in Iraq with Maliki and whatnot. You've got a government. The next big thing to keep an eye on with regard to Iraq, by the way, is the Turks. The Turks are throwing bombs into northern Iraq right now because they're PO'd at the Kurds, because there's a big Kurdish separatist movement in Turkey that the Turks claim is being fed by the Kurds from the Iraqi Kurds. And the Iraqi Kurds, of course, want independence for Kurdistan, and they want that Kurdistan to include part of Turkish Kurdistan. And that's going to be a mess that somebody's going to have to deal with. Thanks, J.D.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
866-987-THOM, TomHartman.com. Drop by our free live chat room. You can make blogs, message boards, all kinds of cool stuff.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video directors, Jim Levinsky, Chris Bryant, and Eric Hamilton. Jovinsky. To phone screener Julie Lulley and writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for our video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various syndicators for this program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV and Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around this country, to Mana Kashvi, Dennis Trunov, Don Rojas, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, to everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It's genuinely appreciated. We are not here without your support. And please, if you know whatever station you're listening on, if you like the show, let them know. And actually, let the sponsors know. Shirley in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just need to ask you a question about the president's recess appointments.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the September, the Labor Day weekend where the majority of Congress, went away from Washington. But they always kept one person there in chambers, I guess.
Yes.
So that they could be considered in session instead of... Right. Okay. Would you explain, how that came about? And
mm-hmm.
I guess it's legal because they did it. But anyway, just explain to me how they're able to do that.
Sure. Go ahead.
And how the president will ever be able to get in a recess appointment.
I would guess between now and November he won't. And because the Republicans have gotten very good at playing this game. The Constitution says very clearly that when Congress goes into recess – that the president, for under extraordinary circumstances, can make a recess appointment, which is good for the remainder of that congressional session. In other words, until the next congressional elections, it could be up as much as 2 years, and then it has to be, you know, redone. And there have been a lot of times when presidents have made recess appointments against the will of Congress. You know, Congress has been refusing to consider somebody, or just, you know, hey, it needed to get done and it needed to get done quickly. There's a bunch of judges, for example, that have unanimous support in the Senate. They would easily be passed, but the Republicans are still refusing to put them into place because this would be viewed as a small victory by President Obama, and they're hoping that there will be a Republican president in 2012. So these Democratic-leaning judges, these more progressive judges, even though they have excellent judicial records and they're widely supported, that they won't be considered, and they'll get more crazy right-wingers in like Robert Bork or Jay Bibee. And so what happened is that the Constitution also says that both the House and the Senate get to make their own rules. So they get to decide when they're in recess and when they're not. And so the rule that they made is that whoever holds the majority in either party can say, we're going to go into recess. And if the House doesn't go into recess, then the Senate technically cannot go into recess. So what has happened is, because the House was taken over by the Republicans, even though these appointments only have to go through the Senate, right? The House is not involved in approving a federal judge, for example, or a cabinet officer. The most contentious one now is this fellow that is up for the financial services or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it really has nothing to do with the House. But John Boehner and Eric Cantor decided that instead of going into recess, as Harry Reid wanted to do in the Senate during each one of the vacation breaks, like both of them normally do, that they would keep somebody in session in the House, forcing the Senate to keep somebody in session in the Senate. And, of course, there's always Republicans willing to volunteer. All they have to do is show up once a day for 5 minutes and say, I'm here. And that just reboots it for another business day, you know. And they don't even have to do that on the weekends. And what that means is that the House and Senate never actually went into recess, so President Obama never had an opportunity to make a recess appointment. In the meantime, you've got even John Roberts, the Chief Justice, writing a letter to the Republic, well, basically to everybody, saying, we've got a crisis. We don't have enough federal judges. You know, stop blocking this stuff. And the Republicans are even ignoring him. But it's all about politics. It is all about politics. This is the both Republican politics and the politics of the Federalist Society, this right-wing judicial group, you know, trying to get their people in. And it's wrong, and it's a tragedy, but that's what's going on. Shirley, thanks so much for the call. Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, we have a minute to the end of the show. What's up?
Yeah, I got a caller on before. Somebody couldn't find a job because he had a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
So tell him to run for Congress like Darrell Issa did. Heck, he got in.
That's right. Darrell Issa is one of the few people who's actually a criminal and in Congress.
Also, you had those two whiners on before about the way you run your show. If they don't like the way you run your show, why the heck are they watching?
Well, good question. I don't know. What's up? You had something? Is that what you called about?
Yeah, that's what I call about, really.
Oh, okay. Well, let me try and get one more caller here. Wesley in Johnson City, Texas. Half a minute, Wesley.
I'd like to comment real quick on the condition of our nation and our country.
Mm-hmm.
This country wants a change. Mm-hmm. We need a great revival to happen. We want to turn the page and enter a new chapter for our nation and for our people and for our children. We have seen a greed, a selfish nature that our forefathers never intended to fall into the lie. We should always treat each other in fairness, to help one another, to build each other up, which will strengthen our nation and give us hope. The principle of greed and selfishness has weakened our people and
well
our
said.
Nation.
Wesley, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. But you well said. I absolutely agree with you, and thank you for saying it. Coming up next, coming up Monday, we'll have the latest on Occupy Wall Street. Why does the New York Police Department have them under continuous surveillance? We'll talk with the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.